I mean, I think one of the most sort of simple, straightforward experiments we did in the entire book was we said to people, if you had to make the worst impression on somebody, what would you say if I asked you whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? And you wanted to make the worst impression. And most people, when asked that question, tell us they would either identify as a strong Republican or a strong Democrat. People think that makes the worst impression. And then when we say, okay, what if you wanted to make the best impression on somebody? People say, I would identify as an independent. Even among Democrats and Republicans, there is sort of a unanimous agreement that independents make the best impression. They're the people that, you know, respondents in our surveys and experiments, they wanted to live next door to independents. They want to work with independents. They would rather work with an independent than with somebody who actually agrees with them on politics.
This is Wally Knox. Welcome to the Political Conversation. We just listened to Samara Klar of the University of Arizona laying out just one of her very interesting findings that appeared in her indispensable book, Independent Politics. It's a book she wrote with Yana Krupnikov of Stony Brook University, and I highly recommend it. The whole topic of independence in our politics resurfaced this November when it became clear just how large a role independence played in determining election after election in the 2022 election. The Republican Party won the turnout race in November, beating Democrats by several percentage points, and that margin would normally have ensured a red wave of victories. But two unexpected things happened. A small number of Republicans decided to back the Democratic candidate for office over the Trump-endorsed MAGA Republican on the ballot. And second, independents, who usually vote against the party holding the presidency when the president is as unpopular as Joe Biden is, this time broke for the Democratic candidate. That was completely unexpected. It was the combination of Republicans swinging to vote Democratic and most independents choosing to vote Democratic that prevented a red wave, not a high Democratic turnout. Who the independents backed didn't used to matter. They were an unimportant 20% of the electorate. But today they are by far the largest political group at 42%, far larger than Republicans at 30% and much, much larger than Democrats at 26%. So there's increasing recognition that in elections with narrowly divided Republican and Democratic voters, it is the decisions of the independents that end up calling the shots. But there is still next to no public understanding of just who the independents are, why they refuse to identify themselves with one of our parties, and how they decide to cast their ballots. Earlier this year, I spoke with Samara Klar reviewing her crucial findings on just those questions. Klar's insights have become even more important following the 2022 election, so let's return to that episode now. The episode began with the voices of six Arizona independents interviewed just before the 2020 election explaining themselves.
I relate it to the fact that it's like we're in the world's biggest gang war. It's the Dems against the Republicans. And I'm always expecting the Jets music to get cued.
I'm kind of forced to be independent. Like, I'll play ball with either one, but ultimately I don't trust them as far as I can throw them because I don't think they're trustworthy.
There's no compromise. There's no coming to the middle, no building of consensus on anything, in my mind.
Literally two halves of the same coin, in my mind.
The Republican Party has, you know, evolved into what it is now because they were willing to put money before they were willing to put the people. The Democrats don't care about minorities until they get our votes, and even after that, they don't follow through on the promises that they make to people who are members of minority groups.
It's a good question because you lose a lot of power when you don't identify one because you can't vote in the primaries and people kind of box you into something else.
We want to see results. We're tired of you yanking our chains for fundraisers and for, you know, voting and then forgetting all about us. So, no.
So let's just open the door. Can you give us an insight into the thrust of your recent work that led to your book, Independent Politics?
Sure. Well, you know, when we ask people to identify as a Democrat or as a Republican, if they say they're independent, we then always follow up with a question, which is there a party that you prefer? So you know, you're an independent, that's great. Which party do you prefer of the two? And about 90%, 75 to 90% of independents will admit that there is a party that they prefer. And what political scientists have found, specifically a bunch of political scientists at Berkeley in the early 90s, was that independents consistently vote for the party that they say they prefer. So if you are an independent who says you prefer the Democrats, most of the time, all of the time, you're voting for the Democrats. If you're an independent who says they prefer the Republican Party, you're pretty much always voting for the Republicans. So sort of the conclusion that political scientists drew in the early 90s was that independents are basically just like partisans. They're closet partisans, as they were called back then. They are partisans who just don't want to identify themselves. And because of that, most political scientists sort of dismissed independents for several decades, saying, you know, there's really no point in studying independents. They're just like partisans. They're just lying about their partisan affiliation. Now, what my co-author Yana Krupnikov and I started to wonder was, well, if they're voting like partisans, why are they calling themselves independents? Especially given that the percentage of independents has actually grown over the last several decades. So we are seeing a pretty consistent increase in the proportion of Americans who would rather not publicly identify with either party. So why is that? Why would somebody who's going to vote for the same party every year most of the time not publicly admit that they are a partisan? And so what we discovered through the course of our research was that in American politics, increasingly, there is a stigma against partisanship. People may prefer one of the two parties. Often they align ideologically with one of the parties fairly well, but what they don't align with is sort of the rancor, the aggressiveness, the hostility, the anger in Washington. And as partisanship is increasingly associated with this kind of negativity, people become less likely to want to publicly say that they're partisans.
So the thing that strikes me about that is your observation that being partisan carries with it a heavy weight these days. There's a cost to it. But the conventional wisdom I bump into every time I pick up a paper or turn on the television is that we live in a completely polarized American electorate. Americans at one point had a middle, but that is gone. Every American has decided, I'm on the hard left or I'm on the strident right. The middle has vanished. That doesn't seem to square with your findings.
Yeah, it's an excellent question. Now, I think that part of the reason is the narrative of polarization in American politics is, I would argue, a little misleading. Now, what is true is that the two parties in Washington have polarized dramatically. Elites in Washington have become much more ideologically polarized. So what we're seeing is Democrats in Congress are consistently more liberal. We see very few moderate to conservative Democrats, and they are more liberal than they used to be. And even more so, Republicans in Washington are consistently conservative. We don't really see a lot of moderate to liberal Republicans, and they are more conservative than they used to be. So polarization is absolutely happening at the elite level. We're seeing two parties that are sorting and polarizing ideologically dramatically relative to what we used to see. Now, if we look instead to the mass public, that is not actually what we're seeing among the American people. The American public is not actually polarizing when it comes to issue positions. In fact, I would argue that Democrats and Republicans within the mass public actually tend to agree with each other on a lot more issues than one would think, especially when you're looking at sort of the media narrative. Now, what we are seeing among the American public is something that we call affective polarization. Affective polarization has to do with the degree to which Democrats and Republicans don't really like each other that much. So over the course of the past several decades, we are seeing Democrats and Republicans in the mass public increasingly tell us that they don't really like members of the other party. But in fact, they are not polarizing when it comes to issues. We do not see bigger issue divergence than we ever have before among the American people. Rather, what we find is that most Democrats and most Republicans among just ordinary people are moderate. Most Democrats say they're ideologically moderate. Most Republicans say they're ideologically moderate. And the vast majority of partisans really don't like the aggression, the hostility, the constant conflict in Washington. They don't agree with it. They don't want to associate with it. And subsequently, when we ask them, which party do you identify with? They say, I'm an independent.
So if polarization were true, if the country truly had polarized, we would have deep, deep problems in our democracy. A whole new criticism of democracy would have emerged. There have been centuries of folks arguing about the merits of democracy, or various kinds of autocratic rule, the autocrats would have gained a new argument, and that is that democracies decay into polarized situations. But the myth of polarization has its own dangers, it seems to me. Tell me if you see this happening. To the extent that the media tells us incessantly that we're polarized, it's telling us that we're ungovernable. It's telling us that it's hard to reach productive compromises that many, 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 many Americans will approve of. And rather, our alternative is just adopt a hard right line and make those folks happy, or a hard left line and make those folks happy. That doesn't sound like a successful governance strategy.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think a lot of the narrative of polarization that we get from media is, it's not made up. I'm not saying media are sort of fabricating false stories. What they're doing is they're reporting on Congress. Congress is indeed very polarized. And largely what sort of cable news, 24-hour news cycles are doing are they're reporting on sort of the loudest, most ideologically extreme, most colorful characters from both sides of the debate. That doesn't represent most Americans. You're exactly right that this misperception of polarization has really troubling consequences. So political scientists Matt Levandusky and Neil Malhotra have found that when individuals are under the impression that the other party is more ideologically extreme, they become more polarized against them. So the more that people misperceive issue gaps between party members, the more likely they are to say they don't like the other party. What I did with some co-authors, including Matt Levandusky, Jamie Druckmann, Yana Krupnikov, and John Ryan, is we corrected these misperceptions. We told people, you know, hey, the modal Republican is actually quite moderate and not that interested in politics, which is true. And when we tell Democrats that, the warmth that they express towards other Republicans dramatically increases. And we find the same thing when we tell Republicans, hey, listen, Democrats are actually pretty moderate. They're actually not super engaged in politics. And when people hear true information about the other party, they become much less affectively polarized. They become much less likely to say that they personally dislike members of the other party. And in fact, what we find in a lot of the polarization literature is when we ask individuals to sort of rate their feelings, their warm or cold feelings towards a member of the other party, they're often picturing elites. So if I say to you, how cold do you feel, or how warm do you feel towards a member of the other party, people will say, oh, I hate them. I hate members of the other party. And if I say, okay, no, don't think about Mitch McConnell. Think about your neighbor who voted for the Republicans. And then they're like, oh yeah, no, he's fine. So people actually don't have hostile feelings toward just their neighbors, their kids, friends, parents, the people they run into at work who may vote for members for the other party. They really hate the elites from the other party. That's a different story.
There's great concern because affective polarization seems to be increasing. We have more and more folks saying, I feel very poorly about the rival party. I'm okay with mine, not wildly enthusiastic, but I have harsher and harsher feelings about the other party. Well, if folks are really not talking about deeper issues, they're talking about the elites of those two parties, and they're correctly perceiving, as we've been discussing, that Congress itself has turned into two different elite groups, highly polarized, then isn't that the case that the public is not as effective, not as full of hatred, as it would be easy to conclude just looking at the surface data?
Absolutely. I mean, if you were to take sort of the thermometer rigs, and just to be clear, you know, for those who may not know how affective polarization is typically measured, it's actually a pretty straightforward measure. What we do is we say to survey respondents on a scale of 1 to 100 or a scale of 1 to 10 or a scale of 0 to 100, how cold or warm do you feel towards members of your own party? Or sorry, actually, I think it's just how cold or warm do you feel towards the Democratic Party? And then how cold or warm do you feel toward the Republican Party? And if you are a Republican, what we would do is we would take your score toward the Republican Party, subtract your score toward the Democratic Party, and that would be your affective polarization score. So it's how warm you feel toward your own party minus how warm you feel toward the other party. Now, what we have found over time is this affective polarization score is growing, meaning the gap between how you feel towards your own party and the other party has been growing over time. Now, as you very correctly observed, what really has been going on is feelings towards your own party have actually stayed pretty stable. Some people say they've actually maybe even gone down a little bit, but it looks like it's been fairly stable over time. The real difference is feelings toward the other party have absolutely plummeted. That's where this gap is coming from. Now, these measures, as we are now starting to see with sort of a little more interrogation, seem to be measuring how people feel toward elites from the other party. So when I say to you, how do you feel toward the Republican Party? Most people are picturing Donald Trump. They're picturing Mitch McConnell. They're picturing their Republican senator. They're not picturing their friends, their neighbors, their colleagues, their acquaintances who happen to vote for the Republicans. And what this means is these indicators that we've been using for several decades now have been giving us a pretty good and useful measure of how people feel toward elites from the other party. They have not been giving us a particularly insightful measure when it comes to how people feel toward each other. And I think you're right. I mean, if we looked simply at affective polarization scores, you would think there would be tribal warfare in the streets every day. And it's simply not the case. I mean, we do see particularly, you know, punctuated incidents of extreme violence. The insurrection on January 6th would be a perfect example. But these things are the exception. They're not the norm. They're appalling and shocking when they happen. When we see real violence between partisans, it's a big deal. It makes the news. It's not normal. It's not something we're experiencing every day. The norm is, you know, people pretty much getting along. And the reason is that most of the time, when you're interacting with people, you don't even know what their partisanship is. I mean, I've interacted with, this morning I dropped my kids off at school, I filled up my tank with gas, chit-chatted with people on the street. I don't know if these people are Democrats, I don't know if they're Republicans, I don't care, I'm pleasant to all of them. And that's generally how people live their day-to-day lives.
So one of the important topics you raise in your book that we've just touched on, but I'd like to really get into, because I actually find it the most interesting work that you're doing, is to discuss the importance of real political activity. The whole subtitle you chose for your book was not just, independents are this or independents are that. The subtitle you chose deliberately said, disdain for parties leads to political inaction. Tell us what your concern was there, and just lay out for us what you think the major points should be.
Yeah, sure. David Magleby and Bruce Keith, these really great political scientists who initially observed that independents tend to vote just like partisans, they're correct. We don't disagree with them at all. In fact, that's a very consistent finding. Independents tend to prefer a party. They tend to vote for that party every year. So the question becomes, okay, so what's the problem? So who cares? And what we've found is, you know, when people are unwilling to publicly identify with a party, even if they're consistently voting for that party, they're also unwilling to do things that are really important for democracy, that are really important for sort of grassroots activism, for grassroots campaigns, things like putting up a yard sign, wearing a button, wearing a sticker, telling people who you're voting for. I mean, these are really important campaign activities, and candidates will be the first to tell you, you know, voting is great, but we need more than that. We need you to knock on doors. We need you to tell your friends. We need you to convince your colleagues. We need you to put up your yard sign. And if people are embarrassed or ashamed or unwilling to publicly identify with a party, they're not going to do those things. They may mail in their ballot or show up on election day and vote for their candidate, but they're not going to be phone banking. They're not going to be convincing anybody in their social circles to support their preferred candidate. And that's a really big problem. Now, something that I find sort of interesting anecdotally is how dramatically more expensive campaigns have become without really seeing a huge return on investment for votes. So, you know, the voting rate is going up a little, some would argue. Our turnout is going up maybe slightly, which is great. But the amount of money that is being poured into every single vote has gone up astronomically. And I would suggest that these two things may be related. The fact that people are less willing to work for campaigns, to volunteer for campaigns, to become engaged with campaigns because they are turned off by all of the antagonism in Washington means that campaigns have to spend more money, more effort to try to get people out to vote.
But there was a tone in your book that actually intrigued me even more. And that was the unstated conviction behind all that, which is that there's something inherently good about political activity, inherently necessary about political activity to have a healthy democratic society. It harkened back to me, not to political science, but to political philosophy and philosophers such as Hannah Arendt, who talked about her views coming out of what's called the civic republican tradition, which argued that the liberal republican tradition, which is focused on voting, focused on atomized individuals, focused on market forces, just didn't capture enough of what it was to be a full human being. She literally harkened back to Aristotle, who said we are inherently political creatures. Now, you don't say those words in your book, but your concern with the retreat from political activity was so strong and so evident that I had to ask you, have you thought about that? Have you thought about the intersection between contemporary cutting-edge political science and some pretty ancient political philosophy?
Yes, absolutely. This is such a fascinating conversation. I'm so happy to be having this conversation with you, Wally. You know, it's funny because when we think about sort of what has historically or traditionally been thought of as the ideal citizen in political science is engaged, is ideological, has strong viewpoints. If you want to think about sort of the way Converse thought about being sophisticated, they had an ideologically constrained set of views, meaning they were liberal on every issue or conservative on every issue, and they were vocal and they participate. And these are already always sort of thought as, you know, the best citizens, the aspiration for what we want our citizens to look like. Now, unfortunately, what we have today are those kinds of behaviors, engagement and voting and being vocal, but only among a very specific set of voters. And that is a problem. The ideologically extreme voters who are sorted, who are polarized, who support ideologically extreme candidates, they represent the minority of voters. That is not the modal citizen. And they are the only ones who are ideologically extreme, who are politically engaged. They are the only ones behaving as, you know, like the ideal citizen. What we ideally would want are citizens from every part of the ideological spectrum to be equally engaged in politics. If the moderate citizens who do not necessarily agree with their party on every issue or who do not necessarily disagree with the other party on every issue are not engaged, then we have a set of representatives who do not represent the greater public. Our representatives are instead representing only the fringe extremes from both parties. And that's a really big problem. And it becomes self-fulfilling because the more that the parties represent only the ideological fringes, the more that media only represent ideological extremes, the less people in the middle really want to be vocal at all. They feel pushed out of the entire system. So what we really need is that level of political engagement, but among all voters, not just ideologically extreme ones.
And in particular, the engagement of moderates within the parties would have that moderating effect on party positions and pass through to elite behavior. Is that your thought?
Absolutely. I mean, what we found is, you know, a lot of these independents or people who don't want to identify with a party, they agree with their party on every issue. They may disagree with the other party on most issues, but what they don't want is the level of sort of partisan aggression and hostility, insurmountable conflict that is conveyed by candidates, by politicians. I mean, we did a content analysis of political, sort of presidential debates over the last 20 years or so. And what we were coding for was the number of words or phrases that presidential candidates are using in debates that convey insurmountable conflict. And we have seen this increase exponentially. So every year, when everyday voters are watching the candidates engage in debates, what they're seeing more and more are two people who express hatred towards each other, who seem like they could never work together, who seem that they don't even like each other. That is not an environment that most people want to identify with. And in fact, what others have found is that following the debates, we tend to see an uptick in the percentage of people who say, you know what, I'm an independent. I mean, I think one of the most sort of simple, straightforward experiments we did in the entire book was we said to people, if you had to make the worst impression on somebody, what would you say if I asked you whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, or an independent? Now, you wanted to make the worst impression. And most people, when asked that question, tell us they would either identify as a strong Republican or a strong Democrat. People think that makes the worst impression. And then when we say, okay, what if you wanted to make the best impression on somebody? People say, I would identify as an independent. Even among Democrats and Republicans, there is sort of a unanimous agreement that independents make the best impression. They're the people that, you know, respondents in our surveys and experiments, they wanted to live next door to independents. They want to work with independents. They would rather work with an independent than with somebody who actually agrees with them on politics. So, you know, we see a lot of these studies, though, you know, people would like to live in a neighborhood with co-partisans rather than out-partisans. That's true, but when given the option, they would actually prefer to live in a neighborhood with independents. That's like the best option for people. So, you know, we see this real disdain for partisan extremity, and it's those people that need to be more engaged, that need to be voicing their preferences, participating in primaries, participating in elections.
So I'd like to shift the topic, if I can, for the moment, and explore what your view is of another political scientist thinking. I recently spoke with Morris Fiorina of Stanford, who I know you have been aware of and in contact with for quite some time. Morris's view is that we live in an era of unstable majorities. And in that view of Fiorina's, the independents play a crucial role. He characterizes the independents as a kind of swing voter, in a way that you don't. You see the independents as composed of hidden Democrats or hidden Republicans with some true independents located in the middle. So you disagree with Morris on the hidden partisan aspect of things. But his whole theory about unstable majorities strikes me as one that doesn't require independents be swing voters. You could have swinging majorities in the election simply because a group of independents were turned on in an election and turned out to vote, or independents as a group were turned off by the process and retreated from voting. In one case, the independent says, I'm going to vote Democrat, or I'm going to vote Republican. In the other case, the independent says, well, I'm really a Democrat, but this time I'm sitting it out, or I'm really a Republican, but not this guy. What is the unstable majorities thesis has implications that are very important in and of itself, that go to the ability of us to have, once again, a well-governed society. Have you thought about Morris's thesis?
Yeah, I'm a huge fan of his work, actually. It's been really influential to me. And what I really like about his work is sort of how he has really taken a very nuanced approach into trying to figure out whether we actually are polarized as a society. And he identifies better than anybody, I think, the degree to which Democrats and Republicans actually do overlap in a lot of ways. He sort of doesn't really buy into this narrative of polarization. And I agree with him on all of that. And I don't know if I agree totally with Morris on sort of independents as swing voters because of their vote choice. I agree that independents can be an important swing voter because they may not want to vote at all. So when we are appealing for independents, I think, you know, I thank God I'm not a political consultant. That is not an area that it seems like a stressful job to be in. But my advice to a campaign seeking to win votes.
High stress, high rewards.
Yeah, well, I guess so. In the short term, today's win is tomorrow's loss. But I would say that, you know, if I were trying to advise a campaign on how to win over independents, my advice would be to appeal to the independents who already prefer your side. Independents are pretty, from what I've seen, about 75 to 90% of them are pretty consistent in their partisan preference. But Morris is right that they don't always vote. And if an independent does not identify with a party, doesn't feel like that party is part of their social in-group, as partisans often do, they are much less motivated to actually take the effort to support that party, particularly when they don't like the candidate. So, you know, we are seeing a lot. Arizona is a great example, actually. It's sort of fortuitous that I ended up here in Arizona, because Arizona has a lot of really classic examples of these sort of moderate centrist candidates who successfully appeal to independent voters. So somebody like John McCain, for example, who I'm sure, you know, few Democrats would identify John McCain as liberal, certainly a conservative Republican in most of his views over time, but John McCain really succeeded in sort of portraying himself as a centrist. And a lot of modern day, you know, contemporary candidates here in Arizona are succeeding. Mark Kelly and Kyrsten Sinema. We now have two Democratic senators in Arizona for the first time in over 60 years. The reason that these two candidates were able to win in a majority Republican state is by portraying themselves as centrist. And when you do that, you can win over independents who don't necessarily identify with the party, but they do identify with sort of a centrist message. And so we are seeing successful cases like that. Not as much at the federal level, although some would argue that Joe Biden really put himself out there as sort of the most centrist Democratic candidate. Whether that's actually true when you look at his policy positions is another story. But for a lot of these candidates, what really is helpful in winning over independents is saying, you know, I'm not a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat or Republican. I'm a centrist. I can appeal to everybody. I think things through one issue at a time. And that is a really great way to win over these independents who just may not vote. And that's what makes them a key voting block.
So an important issue there is to what extent independents do vote consistently from year to year to year. Straightforward example, I'm an independent. I vote for Donald Trump in 2016. 2020 comes along, do I vote for Donald Trump again? And from the exit polling I've seen, there was a major spike in independent voting for Joe Biden. Now, frankly, I'm not a fan of exit polling, but you can take it as a straw in the wind and wonder about it. The exit polling I saw said that independents broke for Donald Trump by 4%. So 4% more independents voted for Trump than for Hillary Clinton. In 2020, Joe Biden got a 14-point spread in the, and this is the initial exit polling stuff, which is not highly reliable. But still, the difference there is stark and clear. So the question does arise. Let me phrase it differently. What proportion of independents are potentially swing voters? And I ask that question because there have been very few political science studies that actually track the same 1,000 people. Wally Knox, how did you vote in 2016? And you record it and you say, and Wally Knox, do you identify as an independent? Blah, 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 blah. And then they track Wally for 4 years, pick up Wally in 2020, ask the same questions over again. What's called a panel study. So you literally can say, I know how independents vote year after year. So there are very few of those studies. And what's your thought about that?
Oh, yeah. Those are absolutely impossible to do for so many reasons. I mean, it's hard to get the attrition rate is obviously huge from year to year. People drop off. You can't find them anymore. And frankly, as a scholar, I mean, it's hard to think, well, I'm going to start this work now so I can publish it in 40 years. So it's a difficult problem. And yeah, it's really hard when we look at cross sections over time, because even if, let's say, for the sake of argument, we find that 30% of independents voted for one candidate in 2016, and then 40% of independents voted for one candidate in 2020. Well, the number of people who are actually identifying as independents is also changing. So we can't necessarily assume that the people who said they were independents in 2016 are the same people who said they were independents in 2020. Because people are now, they're able to change both their vote choice, but they're also changing how they identify from year to year. So it's very difficult to track. Now, what we can do is we can ask independents, how did you vote in the last year? Did you vote for the party you prefer or not? And one thing that's really consistent with independents is they're pretty consistent in telling us which party they tend to prefer. So an independent will say, I tend to prefer the Democrats, but I voted for the Republican. And we do see a little bit of that. But the truth is, independents don't change their vote all that much more than, say, a weak partisan would. We tend to use a 7-point scale to measure partisanship, typically in political science. So that would range from I'm a strong Republican, I'm a weak Republican, I'm an independent who prefers the Republicans, I'm a pure independent, I'm an independent who prefers the Democrats, I'm a weak Democrat, or I'm a strong Democrat. Strong Democrats and strong Republicans are the most consistent voters. They really are unlikely to switch their vote over time. Weak partisans and independents who prefer a party are kind of about the same. We don't really see big differences. So, you know, within that group, I wouldn't say that leaning independents, leaners as they're called, are that much more likely to change their vote than are weak partisans. But one thing I would note about the Donald Trump case specifically, and I think this is kind of hard for any of us to even remember at this point, but in 2016, he was an outsider. I mean, he was not seen by most voters as a conservative Republican. In 2016, Hillary Clinton was a liberal Democrat. She had been a Democrat her whole life. She had been, you know, married to a Democratic president. She was as blue as one could possibly be as a Democrat. And Donald Trump was sort of this nonpartisan, we didn't really know what party he ever even supported. Had he ever even voted? Nobody really knows. His ideology was kind of murky. From a centrist standpoint, Donald Trump was a pretty attractive candidate in 2016.
Yeah, I remember Trump being criticized by Republicans because he would not say, I'm for reforming Social Security, which was a mainstay of Republican thinking and had been deeply espoused by George W. Bush, which contributed to George W. Bush crashing and burning because Americans really didn't like the idea of reforming Social Security. They liked it just the way it was. This is me going deeply into the political science weeds, but I have a political scientist in front of me, and it's too tempting an opportunity. You've discussed with detail, and I thank you for that, how the questions are structured that reveal independents and then reveal that a portion of the independents are hidden Democrats who actually support the Democratic Party and hidden Republicans who actually support the Republican Party. Now, I've had a difficult time with that particular set of questions because it's so different than the structure for when the National Election Survey asks people about their ideology. When folks are asked about the ideology, the survey says, are you an extreme liberal? Are you a, I forget how it phrased, are you an extreme liberal, a liberal, somewhat liberal, a moderate, somewhat conservative, conservative, or extreme conservative. So if I'm being polled by them, I see the entire spectrum in front of me, and I get to place myself and choose. When they ask me about my party orientation, and you describe this completely accurately, they don't do that. They say, "Are you a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent?" I answer that question. Then they go back to the people who said, "I'm an independent." And they then say, is there a political party you think you're closer to? And to me, that always sounded like the pollster is saying to the person sitting there being polled, I'm pushing back at you. I'm saying, well, you just told me you're an independent. Really? Literally, it seems to build in a bias toward answering the question the way the pollster seems to want. The pollster wants you to say, I'm a Republican or a Democrat. That's not done with ideology.
Right. Okay. So this is how I would respond to that. I think it's a really, really thought-provoking question. And I have played around in my work a little bit with sort of how we can ask it differently. For example, I can't really tell you too much about these data because I haven't looked at them too much. But for example, I've been asking recently, just for fun, I've been switching the partisan question to say, are you the strongest Democrat, a kind of strong Democrat, or the weakest Democrat? So I'm kind of trying to see, like, are independents independent, or are they just trying to show their weak partisans? And just a little bit of a preview of what I'm finding right now is it appears that independents who prefer the Democratic Party view themselves as independents. They prefer the Democrats, but they think they're independents. Independents who prefer the Republican Party really just seem to see themselves as, like, the weakest kind of Republican. But to answer your question, you know, I think the question, from what I understood, is why do we do this differently for ideology than we do for partisanship? And my interpretation, you know, I wasn't there in 1948 or whatever when Warren Miller and the Michigan guys came up with these questions, but my interpretation is that in the United States, in this two-party system, partisanship is seen as a type of social identity. It is an identity group that people think about when they describe themselves. Now, is it the most important identity group? I would say no. Other political scientists whom I respect very much would say yes, it is the most important one. That's not what I see when I look at the data. I think it's a good question for debate, but it is a social identity, no doubt. It's an in-group. It's a group people They root for their own party. They root against the other party. They see their partisanship as one of the descriptors that, you know, describes them. Ideology arguably does not operate like that for most Americans. Now, some, for example, Nathan Calmo and Don Kinder would argue that ideology also has sort of an element of social identity. And I think they have, you know, they make interesting arguments. But I think ultimately ideology is not a social identity group for Americans the way that partisanship is. So when we ask people to describe their ideology, we're asking them to describe their political views. Generally speaking, are your views liberal or are they conservative? Describe how you see politics generally. Now, are there problems with that question? Absolutely. What if you're socially liberal and fiscally conservative? That describes a non-trivial percentage of Americans. What if you are socially conservative and fiscally liberal? There's people like that too. What if you are liberal on one issue, it's a super important issue to you, and you're conservative on everything else? So it's not a unidimensional scale, and we measure it as such, and that's an issue. But I think what's important is that it's not necessarily seen as an important in-group. Partisanship is. So when we say to people, think about even the wording. We don't say, do you identify as a liberal, a conservative, or a moderate? We say, describe your views. With party, on the other hand, we will say, do you think of yourself as a Democrat, a Republican, or an independent? So we're actually asking people to place themselves into an identity group, which is a really different type of question. So I think the reason we offer that follow-up is for people who want to say, I don't identify as any of those things. I don't identify as a Democrat. Even anecdotally, personally, I did not grow up in the United States. I grew up in Canada. I did not grow up with a party identity in my family. I don't really even identify with a party to this day. So the question would then be, fine, if you don't identify with a party, which one do you prefer? It's sort of like, you don't identify as a Democrat, you don't identify as a Republican, but is there one that you like best? So it's sort of a different type of thinking from the ideology question, which is not asking people, do you identify as a liberal? Which I think probably very few people would agree with. The ideology question is instead saying, are your views typically liberal or conservative?
But the follow-up question is not literally, you know, which party do you prefer? You're an independent, got it, you're an independent, but is there a party you prefer? That's not asked. What's asked is, do you, how do they phrase this, Samara? I'm trying to remember.
I think it's lean towards.
No, it isn't. No, it is. It's closer to. Do you think of yourself as closer? And this is the peculiar thing. Do you think of yourself as, and it goes back to the think of yourself thing. It's very introspective. Do you think of yourself as closer to the Republican Party or closer to the Democratic Party, period? And I looked at that and said, what does closer to mean? Does it mean I'm less far away from a party? Does it mean I actually feel close to a party? Those are two very different ways to define closer to, and there's no hint as to what it means.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I mean, we are truly asking people in this question to identify themselves with an in-group that they may not necessarily identify with themselves with. And really what we find with independents is most of the independents who say, I identify as an independent and I'm not closer to either, which tends to be about 10 to 15% of partisans, those are the voters that really don't engage with politics. Those are the ones that really don't vote. They don't really have consistent issue preferences, or they say they're moderate on most things. So it's that proportion of independents, the pure independents we call them, who they're not necessarily switching. They're not really a key voting bloc. They're just not voting. So they're the ones who say, I don't identify with either party. I don't even care about either of the parties.
So we've been deep into the weeds and discussing everything from percentages to the fate of the nation. Thanks for engaging in it. Samara Klar, thanks so much for joining the political conversation today.
My pleasure. It was so much fun to talk. Thanks so much for having me.
Pleasure to meet you.
I'd like to close this episode by reviewing Klar's critical points. In her view, independents are not just hidden Republicans or Democrats. They're Americans who are reacting against the rancor and hostility that they hear coming from both political parties. Most Americans are moderate in our views and are repelled by the extremism we see from both parties. Our elected officials are polarized, but most of us are not. And she thinks independents as a group function as swing voters. Not that every independent votes Democratic in one election and then Republican in the next election, but that independents inclined to vote Democratic may decide to sit out an election if the candidate just doesn't measure up. Same for those inclined to vote Republican. The effect is that elections are determined by independents. Her description of the independents certainly fits what we know about the 2022 election. Just look at the collection of Senate and gubernatorial candidates backed by Donald Trump and who devoted their campaigns to espousing the extremist view that the 2020 election was stolen. In Arizona, Carrie Lake and Blake Masters lost. In Pennsylvania, Dr. Oz and Doug Mastriano lost. In Georgia, Herschel Walker lost. And in Michigan, Tudor Dixon lost. In sum, it seems Samara Klar's description of the independents fits what we're learning about the 2022 election. Once again, I want to thank Samara Klar for the interview and my producer, Anna Kumu, for her excellent work. In coming episodes, I will continue to explore the significance of the 2022 election with Joan Williams, author of White Working Class, Lynn Vavrick, author of The Bitter End, and I will invite Mo Fiorina of Stanford back on the podcast for his assessment as well. And I look forward to seeing you on The Political Conversation.